He watched me as I clambered miserably out, shaking with fright and cold, and stood hand on hip, smiling easily at me. "This is a not entirely unexpected pleasure," says he. "I had a feeling you would turn up somehow. Eccentric way you have of arriving, so." He nodded towards the water. "Who is our dead friend?" I told him. "Hansen, eh? Well, serve him right for a meddling fool. I did him rather proud, I think. 25 feet, an uncertain light, and a rather clumsy hunting knife, but I put it right between his shoulders. Rather pretty work, wouldn't you say?" "But you're trembling, man." "I'm cold," I chattered. "Not as cold as he is," chuckled this hellish ruffian. "Well, come along. Ah, but first, the formalities." He snapped his fingers, and two men came out of the shadows behind him. "Michael, take the gentleman's sabre and that most un-English knife in his belt. Excellent. This way." They took me through a ruined archway, across a paved yard, through a postern-like door in what seemed to be the main keep, and into a vast vaulted hall with a great stone stairway winding round its wall. To my left was a lofty arch, through which I could see dimly the outline of massive chains and a great wheel. I suppose this would be the drawbridge mechanism. Not that it mattered now. Rudy, humming merrily, led the way upstairs and into a chamber off the first landing. By contrast with the gloomy medieval stonework through which we had come, it was pleasantly furnished in an untidy bachelor way, with clothes, papers, dog-whips, bottles, and so on, scattered everywhere. There was a fire going, and I made straight for it. "Here," says he, pushing a glass of spirits into my hand. "Michael will get you some dry clothes." And while I choked over the drink and then stripped off my soaking weeds, he lounged in an armchair. "So," says he, once I'd pulled on the rough clothes they brought and we were alone, "the Cote bungled it, eh? I told them they should have let me do the business. If I'd been there, you would never even have twitched. Tell me what happened." Possibly I was light-headed with the brandy and the shock of what I'd been through, or my fear had reached that stage of desperation where nothing seems to matter. Anyway, I told him how I'd disposed of his colleague, and he chuckled appreciatively. "You know, I begin to like you better and better. I knew from the first that we'd get along splendidly. And then what? Our Danske friends got hold of you, didn't they?" Seeing me hesitate, he leaned forward in his chair. "Come along now. I know much more than you may think, and probably can guess the rest. And if you hold back or lie to me, well, Mr. Play-Actor, you'll find yourself going for a swim with friend Hansen, I promise you." "Who sent you here? It was the Danish faction, wasn't it? Sapton's precious bandits."
"The sons of the Volsungs," I admitted.
I daren't try to deceive him. And what would have been the point?
"Sons of the Volsungs, sons of the Nibelungs would be more appropriate. And you and Hansen for to try to rescue Carl Gustav?"
"I wonder," he mused, "how they found out about him. No matter, what did you expect to accomplish in heaven's name? Two of you couldn't hope." "Ah, but wait a moment. You were the mine under the walls, weren't you, to open the way for the good Major Sapton's patriotic horde?" He gave a ringing laugh. "Don't look so surprised, man. Do you think we're blind in here? We have been watching them scuttle about the shore all day. Why, with the night glass in the tower, we watched your boat set out an hour ago. Of all the bungling, ill-judged, badly managed affairs. But what would one expect from that pack of yokels?" He roared with laughter again. "And how did they coerce you into this folly? A knife at your back, no doubt. Well, well, I wonder what they'll think of next."